This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world. Today on Dreamland, a truly remarkable guest has returned. If you go back into the archive and search on the term Laird Scranton, you will find three shows. One about the in 2006 about the Dogon, and then two more in 2017 about the mysteries of Skara Brae, and then another show about Göbekli Tepe. And I'm going to start by reprising Skara Brae after I introduce Laird, because it says, and it's correct to say this on the show description, the editor wrote this: I'm Unknown Country's Out There editor, and I also often write these show descriptions. And I've just listened to one of the most incredible Dreamlands I've heard in my 10 years doing this. And we're going to talk about Skara Brae in a few minutes, because that was in 2017. But subscribers, do not miss either of these Laird Scranton shows. You get into this because you can in the archive. It's very easy to use. Laird is the author of basically of a series of books on ancient cosmology and language, including The Science of the Dogon, Point of Origin, The Mystery of Skara Brae, and most recently, Primal Wisdom of the Ancients, The Cosmological Plan for Humanity, which is a remarkable piece of work also. And that's why Laird is here today, because we're going to get some insights into things like Göbekli Tepe and some of the very deeply hidden material about the nature of our world and who might have been trying to inject a high science into it that, and correct me if I'm wrong, Laird, that gradually degenerated into religion. Is that a fair assessment?
I see it that way. The reference is the more pure connection to science we find. So yeah, we could say that the science degenerated as time went on, and we see remnants of it expressed in religion.
Well, you know, I am a student of the pyramid text in the Pyramid of Unas, and I've spent a lot of time learning how to work hieroglyphics myself in order to understand it. And I see it, and this is really off the topic because Laird doesn't mention this in the book, but I see it as one of the earliest religious documents we have, and it seems to me to be a scientific document that has been changed, is being changed into a religious document, that there are elements of both there. And that's from 3000 BC. But this is what you're talking about goes back even farther, doesn't it?
Right. Well, the main focus of my work is at around 3000 BC, because that's when written texts appear. And if we want to try to anchor a perspective in a credible way, it really helps to have written down in tangible form what some authority in ancient times thought. If you get moved too far back beyond written text, then there are tricks to try to demonstrate what they must have thought. But so 3000 BC is my primary focus, but I go back as far as 10,000.
You're very good at going back as far as 10,000, because your show you did on Göbekli Tepe was mind-boggling. And it was mind-boggling, folks, for the reason that it related the symbols in Göbekli Tepe to the Dogon, and we'll be talking a lot about the Dogon today, and ancient Egypt. But before we go there, and before we get more deeply into this show, I want to reprise Skara Brae, and I want you to tell us what it is and why it's so important.
Okay, well, my work comes primarily out of comparisons between ancient religions, how they understood things. Two traditions that did a very good job of keeping things in perspective were the Buddhist and the Dogon. And so we can cross-check whether one or the other, you know, specifics about what the meaning of a symbol is by comparing what both cultures thought about it. Both see their traditions as an instructed tradition, and both say that initiates were removed to a distant locale, given instruction, and then sent back to teach their compatriots in their original homelands. And Scarabray looks like one of those localities where instruction was happening at around 3200 BC. There was a BBC documentary in 2017 on Orkney Island and Scarabray. This is in northern Scotland. And the commentators can see that there were clearly very interesting things happening on Orkney Island at 3200 BC. They had essentially laid out in stone the alphabet of stages of how matter is created in the earliest megalithic sites in the United Kingdom.
Now, standing stone why sites there? I've been to the Orkneys, and they're very Orkney, let me put it that way. It's a very far away place.
Right, it is a very far away place. It looks to me as if, okay, this instruction was coming from a group that the Buddhists describe as non-human, and the Dogon describe as originally non-material. And it looks to me as if they needed to be within a certain relationship to electromagnetics, and so certain latitudes of the planet lend themselves to that, and Orkney in that period of time sat in that latitude. Another reason is because by sea, Orkney was an extremely accessible place, and if you were a group of teachers trying to bring students in from many different regions of the world, that was an excellent place to get access to by sea.
That's right. It's true, especially because of the fact that the way the currents work around the British Isles, you can get access often to the Orkneys whether you want it or not.
Right. The North Atlantic currents would bring a boat. If you just caught the North Atlantic current and rode it north, it would swing you up just past Orkney and then back around down southward towards it.
Yes, exactly. So that's explained. Now, what is there exactly? You made brief reference to it before, but I want to – basically, it's a number system. Is that correct, or am I wrong?
No, it's not. Numbers are a good way for us to try to represent what happens cosmologically. It's an initial way to conceptualize it. But in the end, it's not really a good way to represent it because numbers have fundamental problems. When you do the math backwards to, say, the origin of the Big Bang or the origin of matter, you reach a point where you either end up with values that look like infinity to us or look like zero to us, and we can't work with those mathematically. You can't divide by zero. You can't represent the concept of infinity. So ultimately, that's a dead end for trying to sort this stuff out. What Einstein did was virtually every theory that Einstein came up with was a qualitative theory, not a quantitative one. They came out of him carefully thinking about situations that involved energies and natural processes, and creating sort of mental metaphors to expose for himself what has to be true about these energetic relationships. One of his famous mind games was talking about comparing the dynamics of what would happen along a moving train if you tossed a ball up and down while you were moving on a train, or if you were driving behind a train trying to catch up with it, things like that. These are mental exercises, and those are really, from my point of view, the better way to get at the truth of what's going on. But on Orkney, what we have, the sequence of megalithic sites we have, repeat shapes that the Dogon and the Buddhists describe. There is geometry. It's the first exercise taught to a Buddhist initiate is to memorize geometry or to master geometry that's used to align a stupa shrine, which is an aligned ritual shrine. The Dogon have a shrine just like it. In Islam, they align shrines using the same method. In China, ancient China, they use the same method. And that alignment geometry, according to Buddhism, recapitulates how space emerges. In other words, if you understand this geometry that's used to align the shrine in the right way, you have a huge clue about how the underlying processes work. As a matter of fact, I was working on that geometry today, trying to work out some details about dimensionality and how dimensions emerge. There's all sorts of interesting stuff that can be inferred from this geometry. Geometry, again, is a good way to approach the subject because what comes out of it depends on the relationship of forms, not on quantities. And so you don't run into that divide by zero or infinity problem. So on Orkney, you have the sequence of shapes laid out in stone. Over the course of about 600 years, the farmers who were on Orkney, the Neolithic farmers, were in their spare time raising these megalithic sites, stone circles and mounds and standing stones and clusters of houses and things.
Now, you have to wonder what exactly was happening. In other words, was it the farmers? You made reference earlier to the fact that there's more than one culture that says information came to us from other levels of being, people from other worlds, conceivably. Why were they doing it? Let me rephrase the question and back it up a little bit into why were they doing it. But first, before we go on, Free Dreamlanders, it's time to listen up and listen carefully because there's important stuff here. There was an incredible UFO wave going on back in 2007. Forgotten all about it? Well, we haven't on unknowncountry.com, and you can still explore it with one of the leading experts who was involved personally, Brian Vike. Listen to this.
A good friend of mine, he's in the UK, believe it or not, and of course I'm in Canada, and between the two of us, just two of us, we pulled in. Now, this is going to be a rough one. I think I stopped it at 434 reported sightings for Canada alone in 2007.
This is an excerpt from one of literally more than 1,000 different episodes of our various podcasts on unknowncountry.com. But how do you access them? We have a powerful search engine that enables you to access them by subject. But now also, when you go to the podcast drop-down menu, you will see at the bottom, Podcast Archive. This takes you to lists of all of our podcasts organized by year. And you can click on any year and browse through everything that's in that year for that podcast. This is a huge website, and we work more every day to make it accessible. For example, subscribers can now listen to the subscriber version of this show on the Castro mobile app. All you have to do is download the app onto your phone or your iPad or mobile device and set it up with the clear instructions. It's very simple, that appear on the Dreamland page after you have logged in. And this will soon be available for all of our current podcasts. So there's so much to do on unknowncountry.com, so much to listen to, and it gets easier every day. And of course, we have a lot of social media on the site. We have the forum, which is free to enter. We have comments, which you can do as a subscriber. We have a weekly subscriber chat on Wednesday nights at 7 p.m. Pacific time. We have frequent video Q&As with our guests and so much more. Unknown Country is a very special place. Another thing, you can listen to lots of Whitley Strieber audiobooks on the site as a subscriber with no extra charge. There's just so much to offer. Do go to Unknown Country right now and subscribe. $4.95 a month. What a deal. We're talking to Laird Scranton about his latest amazing book, Primal Wisdom of the Ancients, The Cosmological Plan for Humanity. You can get it wherever you buy books, basically, and it is it's a valuable resource. Now let's go back to where we were before the break, and I'd like to ask you about what would motivate them to do this. And after all, doing something over a 600-year period, it's like Stonehenge. Or for that matter, Göbekli Tepe or the pyramids. We can't, our culture cannot build for that long. We don't have that much of an attention span. We can't do it. But they could. And why were they doing it? What was motivating them?
Well, that's a complicated question. It comes down to a dynamic between two universes, according to root philosophy called Samkhya in India. Universes form in pairs, and there's a cycle of energy between universes that causes the effects of, if you're familiar with the concept of the yuga cycle, the idea that humanity over in different eras has different sensitivities to things that are non-material, and that over time we're distanced from things non-material, and then in a cycle come back around to where we're again more sensitive to it. Well, ultimately the bottom motivation has to do with what happens in these two universes during that cycle. It reaches a point where the consciousness on one side of the scale essentially becomes locked in, that this cycle of energy also affects how time runs. And so what you end up with is basically the equivalent of a universe that's in sleep mode, that has perfect consciousness but can't take action. And on the other side, you have a universe that's becoming more material, where time is slowing down, that becomes more and more distant from anything non-material. And at the point where the non-material universe is going to be locked in and unable to take action for itself, it needs a compatriot. And so it decides midway through the cycle to establish a structure for society, for humanity, so that there will be a hope that some of us will remember that the non-material side is even there, at the point where it needs active companionship. That's the ultimate motivation for what was happening. From the Dogen and Buddhist perspectives, in a real world context, what was happening was humanity was being given instruction in root concepts that pertain to this cycle of energy. It's all science. It all has to do with how matter forms and how the universe forms and how biological reproduction happens, how consciousness comes about, how dimensions emerge. Very essential root science. And someone had apparently impressed on humanity at around 10,000 BC in the Göbekli Tepe region this system. They first presented this symbolic system that represents these concepts. The cycle of energy we're talking about is a 25,000 or 26,000 year cycle, and so the half cycle is about 13,000 years. And the half cycle that we have just now completed began in the Göbekli Tepe era, from my perspective. So at the very beginning of that half cycle, someone with complete knowledge of this science was trying to impart it in a way to humanity that could be recalled and remembered correctly over a period of thousands and thousands of years. That's what the system is about, the symbolic system is about. My book, Primal Wisdom of the Ancients, sort of explores that idea and says, okay, if we're to entertain the idea that this was an instructed system, we ought to be able to see the hand of a teacher revealed in certain aspects of it. And so the book is all about all the different ways that information was put together that demonstrate that someone who had mad skills as a teacher was behind the system. Demonstrate that it is a system, demonstrate what kind of techniques they were using, compare it to the kinds of techniques our favorite teachers in school use, the ones who taught us something that we actually remember years later.
You know, going back to that period, the period that Göbekli Tepe was being built and then buried, it's a period of exceptional upheaval. Our civilization could not survive it. Absolutely not. Not the way it is now. And yet, here we are at the end of a whole vast cycle, and it seems to me that we're moving into another period of upheaval.
I agree.
And so can you tell us a little bit about, it's almost as if the thesis behind Hamlet's Mill is true, that someone tried to lay down in stone so it would last prior even to the existence of writing the basic principles. And now, why do we need to understand those principles so badly?
The Dogons say that their teachers had two primary motives with humanity, two things they were trying to accomplish. The first was to help us understand our actual place in relation to the broader processes of creation, because this is with the belief that if we understood what our real role was, our real relationship to these other structures, that we would be more likely to make correct choices for ourselves about what we did and what we felt was important. The second thing was to try to establish in us a facility for what they call discriminating knowledge. Now, discriminating knowledge, to me, if you want to simplify the concept, is the ability to draw an inference from a set of facts. Facts are very important, but the real value in education that comes not from just reciting the facts, but being able to take those facts and now extrapolate from them to say, well, if A, B, and C are true, then D, E, and F have got to be true. And that's one of the facilities they were trying to foster in us. Now, one of the reasons they were trying to do that is because the mode of communication, according to Samkhya, between non-materiality is a symbolic one. It's the native mode of communication is a symbolic one. Anyone who's had a dream, a vivid dream, anybody who has ever experienced meaningful synchronicities in their life, anybody who has experienced clairvoyant type effects and so forth, anybody who's involved with UFO contacts understands that things present themselves in terms of symbols. And that set of symbols, the way those symbols are treated in each of those contexts represents a common language. It's the same. If you understand it in one context, you understand it in the others. You can apply one to the others. But oftentimes it involves a degree of intuition on our part. To give an example, those of us who are involved with texting, I'm not really involved with texting, but in the modern world of texting, we'll use abbreviations to represent things because it's easier than writing out the whole word. So if a person were to ask, what does the S stand for in SMH, or in the abbreviation STFU? We discover that S doesn't mean the same thing about those cases. It has a separate meaning depending on the context that the abbreviation is used in, and we all understand the difference.
Right.
We all come to a point where we can infer it. We read the S, and we realize this is not the same S as that other S. Well, the symbolism works the same way. There are, depending on context, there are different meanings that accrue to these symbols. And so part of this facility for being able to infer things is necessary in order to understand that symbolic language.
Let's, speaking of S's, I'd like to talk about the Sakti cult and what it was and what it means.
Okay, the Sakti cult is a tradition in India that goes back further than anybody knows how far it goes. It's an archaic tradition. It's a living tradition in India. Its center of celebration right now in India is along the east coast of the peninsula of India, in a place called Orissa. It is thought to have originated far to the north and west of India in the direction of Gobekli Tepe in the mountainous regions. And it was a matriarchal tradition whose focus was on fertility, and the icons of that tradition, very early in the tradition, were the same set of icons that we see displayed at Göbekli Tepe, that they tended to carve animal images out of rock croppings. Even the word, the name Göbekli Tepe ties to one of their icons. The word, the Turkish word, modern Turkish words, Göbekli and Tepe carry multiple meanings, the way cosmological terms do. But one of the common translations for the name Göbekli Tepe is Potbelly Hill. Well, a potbelly is an ancient icon, an ancient clay pot filled with water that was meant to represent a womb. It was one of the icons of this fertility cult. And so the Shakti cult, from my point of view, carried that symbolic tradition southward and eastward from Göbekli Tepe over the course of centuries and millennia, and carried it into India. The primary goddesses of the tradition were two sister goddesses who were considered to be the two mothers of Ganesha, the elephant god, the Hindu elephant god. And anytime they're pictured in artwork, they're pictured in conjunction with Ganesha. At temples that celebrate these goddesses, you have Ganesha as the gatekeeper, the doorkeeper of the temple. There's a direct connection there. So the Shakti cult is hugely important to me. More than that, there are cultural practices in the Shakti cult that directly tie in sort of signature ways to what we see on Orkney Island at about 3600 BC.
Which is just astonishing.
Right.
I mean, it just blows my mind. Can you detail some of those?
Okay, we'll begin with a burial tradition. On Orkney, they discovered chambered tombs in which they had the bones of many different deceased people intermingled together. The bones had been, before being buried, had been defleshed naturally, sort of left out to the natural elements to be defleshed, a process that takes a couple of days. And then the bones dismembered and the skulls separated from the skeletons, and the bones all intermingled in these chambered tombs with the skulls set separately. Also, very often, the tops of the skulls had been opened with an axe blow. And so researchers on Orkney for a long time took this as evidence of warfare on Orkney. But in fact, if you compare it to the Shakti cult tradition, you realize this is a symbolic opening of the skull. This is to allow the soul to ascend. There are reversals in symbolism that happen at about 3600 BC or after globally, the same reversals in symbolism. What a circle used to represent now is represented by a square. What used to be matriarchal now becomes patriarchal, those kinds of reversals. And one of those reversals is in this burial tradition. And it's about 3000 BC that in Egypt they start wrapping a dead body as a mummy and then opening the mouth to allow the soul to be reborn.
Let the soul out.
Right. Now, the Egyptian term for the opening of that mouth is a word that's written with two glyphs. The first glyph is a glyph that represents the crown of the skull, and the second glyph is the Egyptian mouth glyph. So we have commonality of these two traditions. This constitutes one of those symbolic reversals that in the archaic eras, they were opening the top of the skull to allow the soul to ascend, and then just past the midpoint of the tradition of the half cycle, now they're suddenly opening the mouth to allow the soul to be reborn. Change in symbolism that has rationality to it, but it's hard to get at. You have to have a foundation of knowledge to be able to understand why it happens.
Yeah, well, that's so essential. And, you know, we're trying to recover something of that foundation of knowledge. That's one of the main things this show is actually about, because, you know, I read Hamlet's Mill. It's one of the first books of this type that I read many years ago, and I realized that, you know, it's important to do this, that this is a critical time in our history, and this material from the distant past was targeted to us right now. I believe in the book that you Well, no, no, I'm not going to go there now. I will look for the question I want to ask. But before that, I want to back up and ask another question about the yugas and how they work and where we are in the cycle right now. But before that, Free Dreamlanders, we're going to take a little break, and you're going to be absolutely fascinated by what you hear and so excited by it, you're going to do everything they tell you.
Whitley's new book, A New World, is getting great reviews. American cosmic author Diana Walsh Pasulka says, "Enter this risky new world and leave empowered." New York Times reporter Leslie Keene says, "Riveting. I couldn't put it down." Amazon reviewers are calling it life-changing, mind-opening, the first real description of what contact is like and will be like. Don't miss A New World. As Professor Jeffrey Kripal says in his preface, this book is contact. Get A New World today. Available as a paperback, a hardcover, and an ebook wherever books are sold. And as an audiobook read by Whitley on audible.com.
As always, Dreamland's theme music is The O of Pleasure from Ray Lynch's beautiful album, Deep Breakfast, available at Ray Lynch. I've been looking through our archive, and I found back in 2007 that I had read a short story called The White Moths. Later, of course, I couldn't have known it then, this story would figure prominently, and I mean very prominently, in my entire relationship with Annie after her death. Listen to this commercial that we created back in 2007 for my reading of The White Moths, and you can find it now in the unknowncountry.com archive. You'll find it in Whitley's room.
In the years before his first remembered close encounter, Whitley Strieber wrote many books and stories that reflected his unconscious awareness of what was happening to him. Now, for UnknownCountry.com subscribers, he has begun a program of reading some of these very special stories. Here's an excerpt from the first story.
From The White Moths by Whitley Strieber. The white moth circled her head, and she knew that it was a terrible thing. She began to move out of the room, but the light was long and golden in the gnarled garden, late sun drawing memories from the ruins, and didn't she get already a whiff of some night-blooming flower?
Know how you can hear more? Get the Dreamland Archive back to 2004, hundreds of special interviews, a lively community, Whitley's meditations, and so much more. Subscribe to UnknownCountry.com today. Go to unknowncountry.com and click on the subscribe tab. Our subscription offering is well worth the small cost. Hours of information and entertainment. Join us now.
We're talking to Laird Scranton, his book, Primal Wisdom of the Ancients. And get into Laird Scranton. One of the ways to do that would be to go to your favorite online bookseller and like Amazon, and just put in his name, and you'll find a wealth, I mean a wealth, of extraordinary material. The Mystery of Scarabray, books about the Dogon people. Laird has walked the walk, really. Now, let's get back to these cycles and where we are now, because very frankly, when I look forward in time, I see quite an upheaval coming.
Yes. And I believe that it pertains to the cycle. It's the same kind of upheaval that Plato reported having happened with Atlantis at the end of a cycle, that there was a culture that had been highly ethical for very long periods of time, regarded as the most ethical and knowledgeable culture on the planet, suddenly was taking unethical action and for no reason, trying to attack other cultures and just doing all sorts of degradation morally within the culture, the kinds of things that we've been seeing. So there's an idea that the yuga cycle has an effect on these things. We were talking about the yuga. we might think that in this esoteric tradition that it was a secret tradition because there are aspects of it that smack of that. But in fact, when you get down to an understanding of how the words are put together, every word flatly tells you what it means. Or if you get to the original words, they flatly explain their meanings. And yuga is one of those. The Dogon are the culture that do the best job of preserving the root syllables of this language. And each syllable represents a concept, and you can form more complicated concepts by mixing and matching these syllables, combining them to express the idea you want. Yu is the concept of the gateway between these two universes that the energy cycles through. It's an almond-shaped overlap in space, the Vesica Pisces. It comes. You see it evoked by the geometry that aligns that Buddhist shrine. The overlap of the spaces of the two universes creates these little gateway spaces that the energy sort of passes through and is configured inside of before material forms are created. So U refers to the gateway of that energy and the cycling of that energy, and Ga is a term that refers to temporality. About time. The Dogon would say it refers to past, present, and as if in a dream, which I take to mean future.
Yes, exactly. And it's a strange dream indeed, it seems to me now, because we're looking at a very, very complex future. Now, I want to mention something that I noticed years ago. I've been, of course, very well aware of the work of Rand Flemath and Graham Hancock and Charles Hapgood about the way the planet is essentially unstable. And that is the thesis, the core thesis of Hamlet's Mill as well, the idea that it's very quiet for most of the time, and then it suddenly erupts into extraordinary changes. Now, if you take a geodesical line and you connect all sorts of really old sites, like the plain of Giza, Göbekli Tepe. Göbekli Tepe, but the Giza, Easter Island, Nan Madol. Angkor Wat, I think Nan Madol. In any case, quite a few of them around the planet. What you find is, interestingly enough, they are all pointing all on an axis that points toward a north that's approximately 1,500 miles west of current true north.
Right.
Now, that, as the ice age ended, the ice melted and the weight of that water shifted from the poles, primarily the North Pole, down to the equator as the water melted and moved down to the equator. Now, that's happening again.
Right.
So are we, what we're going to see, and I have to tell you, I have prophetic dreams. I don't talk about them much because not all of them are prophetic. But one that has been persistent for, 30 years, and that my mother had before me, was a dream of huge, extraordinary floods.
Right.
Now, could this happen again, Laird? Is this what they were warning us about?
This is an important aspect of the materialized study. It comes out; it's related to the materialized study. It looks to me as if there are periodic changes. Hapgood thought it was a sliding of the crust of the planet over the inner core of the planet, but there are reasons to think that's not the case. What it looks more likely to me is that there have been intermittent changes in the tilt of the axis of the Earth, some of them small and some of them larger, and some of them electromagnetically induced and some of them induced by a comet strike. And many of the periods of great upheaval that are recorded in ancient texts center on these events where the axis has tilted. Now, we actually have an objective record of that in the form of a series of megalithic sites down in Malta. There are three sets of temple structures that each of the three sets represents a three-stage progression, three different eras in which the temples were built. The form of the temple is it has a narrow opening at the front and a rounded wall at the back. And there's an engineer in Malta by the name of C.R. Sant, S-A-N-T, who wrote about the megalithic calendars of Malta, who has done an extensive analysis of these temple structures. And the purpose of the structure was the narrow opening at the front of the structure served as a lens to focus the image of the sun on the back wall every day of the year. You could watch it, and the temples were designed so that the sun's motion was in even increments across that back wall. You could draw a line across it or hang a plumb line and measure the motions of the sun that were happening. Now, to make a temple like that work only requires two things. It requires that the aperture at the front of the temple be a particular number of degrees of opening, and those numbers of degrees depended on where the temple was situated in terms of latitude. Today, if we had one of those structures situated at the equator, the opening would need to be 23.5 degrees, which is the tilt of the axis of the Earth. Now, the farther north you move, the more that has to be adjusted. By the time you get to the latitude of Malta, it needs to be more like 28 degrees opening. And then you need a back wall that's curved in the right way to be able to basically image the sun. This is a photographic, almost a photographic technique. It's a technique a camera works on. If you get too far north, the technique doesn't work. Now, the perspective of the author, Mr. Sant, who I'm in contact with, is that those huge structures were built, and these structures, the apertures of the structures change in each of these three sets of temples in parallel with each other. At one period, the aperture is as little as 18 degrees of opening, and at one point it is as wide as 33 degrees. And there's one structure still there that is functional, where it's 28 degrees, which is the proper size for right now. So these structures physically record what has got to have been a physical change in the tilt of the axis of the Earth, because the structure doesn't work unless that aperture is correct for the latitude and the tilt. Now, his perspective is they were doing that in order to track a calendar for agriculture. But that makes no sense to me, because there's a far simpler way to know when to plant and to harvest.
Yeah, all of the long count, I've read of a number of stories of the long count calendars that are suggesting that they had something to do with agriculture, but that can't be true. I agree with you there. Go ahead.
Now, from the structure on Malta, there's one structure called Hagar Quim, Q-I-M. Now, Hagar Quim also includes a stone window that was set up, a pair of pillars that you can peer through that frame an island called Filfla. Now, in the distance from Hagar Quim, if you watch Filfla, you'll see the sun rise and set, and you can track its motions over the range of that island. It sets southward at one solstice. It sets in the middle at the equinox. It sets northward at the other solstice. That technique is a technique that is used expressly on Orkney. There's a pillar called the Watchstone, from which if you stand there and you view to the west the island of Hoi, there are two mountains there with a gap in between that perform precisely that same function. Any farmer could take a glance at where the sun rose or the sun set every day against that backdrop of the mountains and know when to plant and when to harvest. And that technique is used all over the world. I've tracked it up through the Hebrides. I've tracked it. It's there at Abydos. It's there at Akhenaten's capital city, Akhetaten, expressly being used in that way. So no one needed to build a multi-megaton structure to track the motions of the sun for agriculture. There's something else going on. And what it looks like to me is an obsession with having forewarning about if the sun was off its track, which is how it would appear if there was a change in process with the tilt of the axis of the earth. In ancient China, they invented the earliest form of writing called the oracle bone writing to track the motions of Venus, which Velikovsky connected with major calamities on the earth. So it looks to me as if we have carved in stone on Malta objective proof that the earth's axis has changed its angle, the tilt of the axis has changed its angle on numerous occasions in the past. The Egyptians flatly say the sun rose where it formerly set three times in their historical memory. The ancient Chinese make the same claim. At one point, the Chinese emperor has all of his advisors gathered around him. There's a period of days where things are dark, and the advisors are trying, they're placing bets on where the sun will rise when they see it again. And nobody guessed east.
But now what you're saying is not that there's a slight change, but that the planet will literally flip over. Am I right about that?
Right. Now, it's hard to say whether it simply rolled a few degrees or whether it rolls over and settles out someplace a few degrees different than where it was. There's also a question as to whether the North and South Poles change places. There's science, but we have objective proof that that kind of sort of thing must have happened in the past because we have gigantic petrified forests down in Antarctica that couldn't possibly grow in the amount of sunlight that's there. These are of the same variety that Lewis and Clark found on the West Coast when they arrived in Oregon. The same quality of forest, only petrified. We have examples of mastodons in Siberia who were killed and frozen so that their final meal is still left undigested in their stomachs. So over the course of less than a day, those mastodons moved from a temperate climate to a frozen climate and never again thawed.
You know, there's something I noticed that I don't think is written anywhere, and that is this. The Ötzi, the Iceman, who was found in the Alps,
right,
was running through an alpine meadow when he was killed. He then fell in snow, and gradually that alpine meadow turned into a glacier. In other words, he must have been there running through that meadow at a time when there was an extraordinary change taking place in the climate. And that's about 5,000 years ago.
Right.
Now you go to the Peruvian Andes and the work of a professor, Lonnie Thompson, who was a glaciologist who dug down, bored down into the cores of the base of these glaciers and discovered plants that were about 5,000 years old that were just like the food in the mouths of the mastodons that you were talking about, or the mammoths, rather.
Right.
Quick frozen, so quickly frozen that their cells weren't even broken, like they had been frozen for frozen food. Instantaneous freezing.
Right.
What accounts for that? What in the world happens? And that was 5,000 years ago. What is this? Help us.
We can, if we simply look at a globe.
Well, Laird, listen, before we do this, I hate this is our, thankfully, our last interruption, folks, free Dreamlanders. I urge you to subscribe. Then you won't hear any of these interruptions. We'll be right back.
The new unknown country is here, and it has so much to offer. Our huge archive of Dreamland, plus the full run of William Henry's revelations, Anne Streber's mysterious powers and her incredible contactee interviews, Whitley's Communion, Secret School, Transformation, and Majestic ebooks, his powerful meditations, and so much more. Plus every week, the full subscriber versions of Whitley's Dreamland, Mike Clellan's The Unseen, and monthly, Jeremy Vaney's The Experience. We offer subscriptions either by credit card or PayPal, either automatic renewal or annual or longer subscriptions without auto-renew. Plus, it's easy to cancel if you wish. Do it right in your account. Plus, a live chat every week on Wednesday nights at 7 p.m. Pacific, and so much more. Go to unknowncountry.com right now and subscribe. Keep this incredible site going and have a great time doing it.
Unknowncountry.com subscribers have access to a vast treasury of information. Listen to what Dr. Robert Schock said. He's an expert on the past, and for that reason, he also knows a great deal about the future.
We are re-entering, as you say, a debris field, and when you have a debris field like this, it enters the solar system, it energizes the solar system as you have things going into the sun. Even clouds of dust particles, for instance, it will energize the sun, it will destabilize the sun. This is what we saw at the end of the last ice age in approximate terms, about 13,000 years ago.
And just in the past few days, more enormous meteors have been sighted, and this goes on continuously, more and more every year. We live in a time of great change in a world that doesn't like to look at things as they are. UnknownCountry.com offers extraordinary information, a vast archive that you cannot find anywhere else. Subscribe today. Help keep this website going, because without you, there is and can be no us. Go to UnknownCountry.com. Right now, click on the subscribe tab. Get started. We're talking to Laird Scranton, Primal Wisdom of the Ancients, and many, many other books. All of them total fascination, as you can hear. Okay, Laird, let's go back to that moment 5,000 years ago we were just discussing.
Okay. If we look at a globe, looking at North America and the region from North America to the Arctic, you'll notice the circular shape of the Gulf of Mexico and the circular shape of the Hudson's Bay. And it's possible to easily imagine that those shapes were caused by the depression of an ice cap, as if that region of the world at one period of time had sat where Antarctica is now. We also notice that ice ages occur in a very strange way, that Northern Europe isn't glaciated at the same time North America is. Rather, what we see is that spots on opposite sides of the planet are glaciated at the same time. That makes us think that what was really going on is that those regions were sitting at the poles at that period of time. This was not a change in climate as much as it was a change in tilt of axis. Now, it's reasonable to think that one of the ways that might be caused is electromagnetically, that may perhaps the periodic fluctuations in the magnetic pole are associated with periodic rolling of the planet. Well, we're in the midst right now. We're watching our magnetic pole shift. Graham Hancock today linked a NASA article that says that there are two sort of nodes of the magnetic pole down in the southern Atlantic that they can see now are about to split. They're going to separate. They're going to divide like a cell divides. And nobody knows what happens when that happens. So it might well be that we are geologically on the verge of another one of those shifts. But, of course, in geological terms, that might mean tomorrow or it might mean 300 years from now.
Now, we have, of course, a situation with the magnetic field right now where magnetic anomalies are becoming very extensive across the whole planet. And there's every evidence that the magnetic field could slip into chaos at some point, even quite soon.
Right. And it's moving in the same direction and about the same distance as we see the spacing of those Gulf of Mexico, Hudson Bay sites and Arctic sites. So there's a pattern to this stuff.
So what would happen if this planetary shift movement took place? What would its dimensions be now, based on what's happening with the magnetic field and what you can see from the past?
It's hard to say, and I'm sure it would depend on where on the planet you happen to be sitting, and where that got shifted to. But in the worst case that I know of, Velikovsky writes about entire islands in Siberia that are formed from the intermingled bones of animals of various eco bands.
Well, you know, they're the ivory mountains in China, which are that. Ivory from animals.
That massive surges of waves flow across the planet, massive tsunamis that just destroy everything in their path. That's the worst case. Now, whether there's something gentler than that, I'm not sure anybody can say. It looks as if the Orkney sites were abandoned around 2600 BC, about the same time the Malta sites were abandoned. They don't know why they were abandoned, but it looks to me as if the Orkney site was abandoned because suddenly that area of the world was shifted to where it is right now, that previously that it had been in a slightly warmer climate and then shifted a little bit northward, and now suddenly a lot of the things that they were doing, a lot of their agriculture and things like that, no longer function the same way. These changes in magnetic pole or magnetic field are associated with mass migrations, which implies climate change. At one of them, we see all the Germanic tribes move south for no reason. We see major changes in climate in China around 739 BC, that such that crops that had been grown there for thousands of years suddenly couldn't be cultivated there. We have major climate change just before the foundation of Rome. We have, at 709 BC, we have a huge number of odd effects. We've got a major fluctuation in the magnetic pole. We've got major volcanic activity. We have an inexplicable change in what looks like the relationship of the Earth, the Moon, and the Sun. Every total eclipse of the Sun that has happened since 709 BC, we can use computers to retrospectively calculate and verify that there was a total eclipse of the Sun at that spot on that day. Not a single total eclipse can be verified that way that happens before 709 BC. Something major happened.
That is major. That's really extraordinary. But of course, there's a kind of psychological block in the scientific community about catastrophism. And it's not because people are afraid. It's because if you make extreme statements in science, you have to be prepared to back them up or lose your job.
Right.
In other words, it's turned out to be more like a religion, and it stifles speculation like crazy. Is there anything in the historical record at that time that might give us an idea of what they were perceiving and experiencing?
Well, Velikovsky's Worlds in Collision identifies that era as one of the eras where there was a close approach made to the Earth by another planet. He says Mars, based on ancient texts in various cultures that Mars made a close approach at that point in time. And the effects that we see recorded, these kinds of effects, would be commensurate with that kind of an event. But scientists in the various fields aren't going to allow it, even though there's evidence that might pertain to it.
Well, no, they're not going to allow it. What sort of evidence does pertain to it?
For one thing, radiometric dating doesn't work across that boundary. That something, probably all the volcanic activity, caused a change in the amount of... Okay, radiometric dating works on the assumption that there's a constant rate at which ions are absorbed by organic material as it decays. And so it looks as if the volcanic activity put more ions into the atmosphere, and so suddenly those rates changed, and now they can't use it as a way of calculating over that, across that boundary. They have to use fudge factors that they presume are right. But the same thing happens, as far as I'm concerned, with those total eclipses are the anchors for our perspective on where the stars were in relation to us. If we can't hit the total eclipses, if we can't calculate those mathematically, it should be clockwork. If we can't calculate those, we have no idea where the stars were prior to 709 BC in relation to us. We don't know what our orientation to the stars was. So there's lots and lots of different reasons. There are ice core evidence. There is tree ring evidence. There's climate evidence. There's volcanic evidence. All sorts of different factors that say something really big happened at 709 BC.
Well, of course, now there's a historical, an extensive historical record there. At that point in China, in India, in the West, in Greece, and certainly in Egypt. So is there anything written in that record that would suggest this?
Yes, we have synchronized astronomical records between ancient China and ancient Korea, so there's certain things we can derive that way. But trying to line those things up is tricky stuff. Velikovsky discovered a 700-year mistake in the alignment of certain historical records that everybody was basing their histories on. He realized there was this whole 700-year sequence of events that gets repeated twice, if you're paying attention, that in with slightly different names for places and so forth, but it's all the same sequence of events that happens. He says someone made a mistake in trying to put those together. It's a tricky process. And what's also odd is that the astronomers are saying that the people on the ground who were reporting total eclipses were not reliable reporters, and that's why we can't calculate the eclipses. But the historians are using those same reporters as credible sources to define the timeline that history rests on.
Yeah.
So you don't even have to cross fields of study.
If we don't want to believe it, then it doesn't work. But if we do want to believe it, it works.
Right. So this is why it helps to get comparative viewpoints from different fields of study, and that's one of the things that academia is not good at, that it's sort of a no-no to step out of your field, even though these days most major discoveries are being made by somebody outside the field.
I want to read, we're getting close to the end of our first hour, and in our second half, or third half hour, I should say, we're going to get into the UFO connection, but I want to read something from my dream book. I keep a dream book. I've been keeping it since 2016, and in this dream book, there are quite a few dreams like this one. August the 7th, 2020. A terrifying flood dream. As always, I am at my country house, that's the family country house in Texas, when a massive flood of black water comes roaring down the valley. The house is situated on a valley above a river. This time, two huge black waves threaten to overwhelm the house, but don't. I see San Antonio being swept away. I am in the air at that point. There is a fragmentary memory of a huge black sea covering West Texas. And when I say black, I mean the water was as black as coal. I believe my mother had a dream back in the early 60s of the flood coming down the valley, which she did. In fact, the dream was so vivid, she thought for a long time that it had really happened until we explained to her that the valley hadn't been flooded out because you could still see the trees and farms and everything. Anyway, it ends if maybe she, it will happen if some kind of shift takes place. That is the last dream recorded in the dream book so far, and since then the dreams have all been quite subterranean. Now, folks, when we return, we are going to, or for subscribers, we're going to keep on just straight through. We're going to talk about the UFO connection and the connection between the close encounter experience and a lot of this ancient wisdom, which is just quite incredibly fascinating. Laird, I thank you so much for staying with us for the final half hour. Laird's latest book, Primal Wisdom of the Ancients, The Mystery of Scarab Brae, the books about the Dogon, there's so much there. An enormously informed person, one of the greats, in my opinion. And you heard all of the amazing information and detail that we just enjoyed in this wonderful show. So do get Laird's books, Laird Scranton. He doesn't have an active website, but that's okay. The books speak for themselves. So, Free Dreamlanders, thank you very much for being with us. And subscribers, we're just going to keep on keeping on.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Strieber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Strieber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.